In this episode of Movie Rollers, we wrap up the LA Film Festival 2015. It's time for Movie Rollers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yusti as well.
Movie Rollers is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Hello, hello, hello.
Greetings.
Hello.
So this is kind of our post-LA Film Festival wrap-up podcast. I think we've had two other episodes and covered ridiculous number of movies so far, so hopefully
12, I think,
these podcasts aren't boring you to tears, but it's been a packed film festival. What an amazing year overall. I mean, we'll maybe have some closing thoughts at the end, but just going into this third day, we were already satisfied in terms of what we'd seen, and let's talk about what else we saw today.
This is like when you have that really big meal and you're like finished, and then literally 2 hours later, someone says to you, I've made your favorite dinner.
Right.
And you have to eat it and you're stuffed to death, but you eat it because it's so tasty. And somehow you make room and it's still tasty.
If you love movies.
So where should we start? We have six or seven movies to talk about. So let's get cracking.
Let's start with Ayanda and the Mechanic. So I didn't get to watch that one. Yazdi, you saw that one.
This was
one that came with kind of high praise before the film festival. So basically, this is directed by Sarah Bletcher. And it says, within a multi-African Johannesburg community, a young hipster designer saves her deceased father's prized garage by refurbishing classic cars until family secrets and a corrupt legal system threaten her passionate resolve. So this is out of South Africa. I do like these movies that are coming out of countries where, you know, typically we only see like war-torn poverty. So how was it, Yazdi?
So it's been now a little while since I watched the movie and I had one reaction to it. And, you know, you were saying in our earlier podcast, I saw this movie and I had some issues with it, although I have tremendous respect for this movie and a lot of love for it. But I had some issues for the movie, issues with the movie, which I'll talk about in just a second. But this movie has not left me. It refuses to leave me. And it's not that it's doing something or it touches on a topic which is unusual or taboo, but somehow these lives and these people and these characters have stuck with me. And I think that's the measure of a movie success. And I think the movie's biggest crime, if you will, is that there is enough movie here for maybe three movies.
Wow.
And again, it looks at...
Tries to get it all in.
It tries to get it all in. And you know, the movie got a very, very rousing... It's a long movie. It's almost maybe a little bit more than 2 hour long movie. And at the end of it, you know, the cast was there, the director was there, and they got like huge ovation from everyone. And you can tell that this movie has meant so much. And one of the things which really resonated for me, which the director said, is that most of the movies which have come out of South Africa have been about causes. They have been about apartheid. They've been about, you know, AIDS. They've been about, you know, slavery. They've been about all these issues. And she says, enough of that. And she was saying, it's time for us to make movies about people, you know, enough about causes. And that really resonated for me. And I think this director, who is white, has, this is her love story of the culture where she grew up in and mm-hmm. the people she knows. And it's only by virtue of, she wants the whole world to see this world and want to see these characters and see what they're struggling with and how their dreams are broken. So I think the movie's biggest fault is how ambitious it is. And you were talking about it stylistically just everywhere. I mean, there's animation in this movie. There is a whole device where different characters are talking to the camera at different points, and it's built in as a almost as a documentary, because somebody comes at the start of the movie and says, you know, I'm making a documentary and I'm going to interview all these characters, and they come in at different times and talk. So it's really crowded with style, it's crowded with characters, And to give credit where it's due, I think ultimately through the story of Ayanda, it does want to tell the story of all of Africa at this point. It's about a nation growing up. So it's beautiful.
Not similar to, not in terms of the story, but in terms of the message it's trying to get across, like Sweet and Vicious, right? These.
So we spoke about that one yesterday, yeah. Where obviously the filmmaker here is.
Yeah, they're really excited to tell about their nation, about their country, well, where typically we're only used to seeing one side of it.
It is interesting. I mean, you know, our worldview here in the US is very tainted by, you know, specific points in a country's history. And it almost, you know, we define...
And a 24-hour news cycle.
Right. But we define often a country by, you know, one or two moments in its history. And we forget that these are living, breathing, you know, countries with people who have lives just like us.
Yeah.
And I think it's really nice, again, to see things like this coming to the film festival, where there's a recognition that, you know, we don't need to have a film about Ireland that's all about, you know, the Catholic Protestant IRA struggle, yeah. Or, you know, it you know, we can have these issues. So yeah.
And I think in comparison to Sweet and Vicious or Las Malas Lenguas, I think that movie was very, very intimate in terms of these characters, whereas Ayanda and the Mechanic really, especially in its last act, really opens up, and it's about all of those characters. And I think in a way it bites off more than it can chew, and I think this would have made a great HBO series. Okay, honestly, this would have made an amazing HBO series.
About the ladies detective agency.
Yeah, so it has a lot of the texture.
Pet detective, but I wanted to call it
the number one lady.
The number one ladies
detective. That's when are they making? Are they making?
I've got the books on my shelf.
Love those by Alexander McCall Smith.
Yeah,
but
does it suffer from? You look at kind of a lot of world cinema, and then you compare it in some ways to classic literature, where you have these stories that have so many elements in them that they're just trying to get out, you know. And I look at something, I don't know, like a lot of Bollywood stuff, where you have these meandering stories and they throw in new characters halfway through and new elements. Does it kind of suffer from that kind of storytelling that maybe we're less used to because we're so used to the Hollywood way of doing things?
And maybe that's all it is that it's just a different kind of storytelling. Because my original, and this is what I wrote down in my notes, my original reaction was that it almost seemed like there were too many loose strands and they just got exhausted and they just said, okay, we're just going to tie everything up now because it's 10 minutes and the movie needs to end. It kind of felt like
right.
That. Or sometimes, you know, there is a beloved show on television which has been through season after season, and then suddenly the network says, that's it. It's the end of the series. And then they have to wrap everything up in the next three episodes because, you know, the whole thing is going to come to an end. So it kind of had that feeling. And I think I was being harsh in judging it that way. Maybe it was the intent all along to introduce new characters. In a way, it's kind of breathing, and it kind of moves its focus from Ayanda to her mom and Ayanda to her mechanic boyfriend, lover. But I like the fact that it's funny, it's very authentic, it's never looking down or judging or any of that. These are real breathing people. But it's about everything. It's about, you know, how stifling corruption is and how the police are in on everything and how it's so difficult in any kind of a third world country to be very creative and to be independent and not get crushed by, you know, the big... You know, the David versus Goliath, and it touches on all of these things, and it really left a mark on me. I didn't think it would, but, you know, I've been thinking about it. So it's a big sprawling, it feels very epic.
It doesn't sound like it has commercial potential here. I mean, is this likely to get a release? I mean, from what I'm hearing, it's a movie that I would love to go see.
Me too, I think it would be like going on vacation.
I can't see from what you've said this movie getting, you know, kind of a big US release. Just based on the kind of flavor and texture that I'm hearing about.
I think if it's marketed appropriately, it might. And I think people will go and they will enjoy it. It's not pat.
Okay.
And it's not simple. It's sprawling and ugly and you know, depressing and you know, it has rough edges, but it's beautiful to look at, and you know, the actor who plays Ayanda is so committed to that role. You know, there's no effort at any point to make her lovable or likable, and she does a lot of stupid things, but it's about her and the mechanic.
I think I'm going to like it.
Yeah.
Okay. So next up, we have so many movies we can talk about.
How about the babushkas?
Should we talk about the babushkas of Chernobyl?
From South Africa to Chernobyl.
Yes. So the Babushkas of Chernobyl is from directors Holly Morris and Anne Bogart. And the description of the movie is that in the radioactive dead zone surrounding Chernobyl's reactor number 4, a defiant community of elderly women cultivates an existence on some of the most toxic land on Earth. So now that I'm reading the description, I want to see it. And I missed out on seeing it. And then apparently there was also a short which was shown with the movie called The Timekeeper. I don't know if that was part of the screening that you attended, Joe.
There was a short played, but they didn't show The Timekeeper. They switched it out for something else. So can't remember the name of the short that they showed.
But what about the babushkas of Chernobyl?
I thought it was the one about the atomic clocks. The Timekeeper.
Oh, thank you, Rashmi. Gosh.
Yeah.
This is what happens with film festivals. You saturate.
All merges. Yeah.
And yeah, so there was many. A fantastic little
that
short.
Was
yeah,
a very
it was.
Good short. Yeah.
It was about. It's a portrayal. It's a little.
Like a little vignette.
Like a 5-10 minute character study of a guy who works at the government agency where they maintain the atomic clocks. He's.
Is this animated?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's all about. The precision and the rigor and the obsessive nature of this particular individual in terms of how he...
Well, and how important he considers his job, and it's damn important, which is what they tell us.
No, absolutely, but that, you know, it's a real geek out on kind of time and concepts of time and, you know...
And truly what 1 second actually is. Like a second of time is the time it takes for this.
For a certain, you know, it's atomic time. So it's like degradation of cesium by a certain amount, and that's measurable. And then you can, so it's, you know, but the universe then plays. If you believe in things like relativity, and I say believe in, it's a physical principle. Relativity starts to mess with time depending on distance, depending on gravitational fields and so on and so forth. So when you get super accurate about measuring time, then you have to factor in other factors that the time on the surface world. Of the Earth versus the time, you know, 10,000 feet up is actually different. So it's got all these
We've
things.
We've probably talked longer about it because we're so fascinated by it than the movie itself.
It was great stuff. Nice. Sorry, I didn't make any notes on the movie, but it was terrific.
What about the babushkas?
Where do I start with this one? This movie is more of a portrayal of these women who live in what is essentially a no man's land, and these are places where when Chernobyl exploded back in the 1980s. And everyone was evacuated. Some people just returned to their homes because it was all they knew. Their entire way of life depended on living within these communities. And you know, the film makes some arguments that they actually did better than some of the people that were rehoused into, you know, essentially ghetto-style communities because, you know, hundreds of thousands of people had to be moved out of their homes. But... their philosophy on life is just as admirable, and more than anything, this movie captures the spirit of these ladies. They have such a wonderful attitude about life and the difficulties of life. Their sense of humor, you know, it was just it's a very real documentary peek into a world that we find almost impossible to believe. Like, why would you choose to live somewhere that is known to be incredibly dangerous to exist in? And you know, it addresses many of the things that we talk about often in terms of, you know, life and lottery and survival. And you know, they've been living there comfortably for years and years, and they're not necessarily suffering physical ailments, but it's harsh conditions. Rashmi,
I love this documentary. I mean, I love documentary, and I was kind of feeling by this day that I hadn't seen enough of them. So I was really happy to see this one. I was fascinated by the topic, especially because we saw a movie probably about 2 years ago. I think it was called The Diaries of Chernobyl. Remember that horror movie?
Yeah. Oh, that was a disaster.
Which was a disaster movie. But I was kind of fascinated by the fact that, you know, what does happen to a place when kind of complete annihilation happens? So to me, this is about two things. One is that the Earth was here before us, you know, before we came along and put buildings and structure and roads in place. There were trees and rivers and...
spiders.
Yeah, all of those happening. And so basically now when these whole villages have been evacuated, the Earth has taken over again. So that's interesting to me. And then, like you said, Joe, it's about the human spirit, about the resolve of these women and the spirit of these women and their unwavering desire to be in the place that they call home. And they're comical. I wanted to hug these women. Like, I want to go and visit them because they seem so much fun. They make moonshine. They make their own, you know, they grow their own vegetables. They live off the land. They get some from the government.
There are no men here?
Well, I guess, you know, look, these are older women and much of the community's died off, and it's called the babushkas of Chernobyl.
But yeah, there are no men in this community. I don't know why the movie, if there are, why the movie stays away from them. I think it's really about this community of women who, you know,
support each other.
Yeah, I think maybe their husbands were you know, affected and died, you know, with the whole Chernobyl thing. So they're the kind of the remaining ones, but...
Yeah,
it's as close to kind of a dystopian environment as exists on the Earth right now. I mean, it's kind of mad. It's like this place in North Korea are just two like really weird places for people to exist.
Yeah, you're gonna hate me for saying this, but when you were talking about it, the image which came to mind, or what I was reminded of, was, you know, those women that Charlize Theron's character runs into in Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
You know, these women who are living by themselves in this desolate land, and they're kind of, you know, just surviving this dystopian world around them.
I don't think it's dissimilar, except these are real and they have more, you know, more real challenges.
Sure.
I think what's really fascinating, and then there's this other aspect to the documentary about these kids. I guess they're sort of like in their probably early 20s now, mid-20s. These kids who play these video games about Chernobyl. I don't know, Joe, you'll have to help me out with what the game is.
So there's a game called Stalker, and it's set in Chernobyl. And, you know, it's one of these games. Games get very realistic these days, so they've obviously done some, you know, topography. And it's kind of like the Chernobyl Diaries, where, you know, Chernobyl is basically, you know, this background for... this horrible radioactive accident, and then you've got mutations and monsters.
Creatures,
right. So Stalker is this online phenomenon. It's a multiplayer game, and people feel like they've gone to these places. So video gamers, being youth and often stupid, with the stupidity of youth, I'll say that, want to experience some of these places for themselves. They want to check out these environments that they feel like they know. They're so real in a game. So they want to go there for real.
Yeah, and so there's this whole aspect of the documentary that follows these two stalkers who are basically trying to make their way to the zone where the actual the buildings that were in the Chernobyl Diaries have actually
collapsed.
Yeah, have collapsed, and so it follows them. And I think that was interesting to me too. And I wrote down one of the quotes, you know, and he said, it's because the filmmaker basically says, look, this is like a forbidden land and you shouldn't be here. And it's within that 10 kilometer zone of, you know, they have this 10 kilometer zone and a 60 kilometer zone. And he basically said, it's the feeling of going somewhere forbidden. Right. And what's interesting is that one of the guys who's the stalker, actually his grandfather died as a result of the accident. He said, my grandfather would be horribly disappointed that I'm coming back here. But what was interesting was that they do take us into one of the apartments, and it is exactly like in the diaries, where it's a time capsule now, right? These things, I mean, people had to like basically run from here. And this is a time capsule of 1984 when the accident happened. I think it was 1984.
1987, I think it was.
Okay. So anyway... brilliant documentary. I really, really liked this. This was just a wonderful documentary made by women, about women, and a bit more. But more than that, I think it just captured the human spirit and what it means to be family and to return home. and about things that are important to you. And I think, like Joe, I was very fascinated that medically these women aren't more sick. They've actually done better health-wise than the people who had to evacuate. So there's this whole underlying feeling of, like, what is it that gives you life in the long run? Is it happiness or being safe, traditionally safe?
Okay, movie.
Speaking of documentaries, should we move on to the next documentary?
Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
No Más Bebés. I love the title. I want to keep saying it again. No Más
No
Bebés.
Más Bebés.
And no more babies. Just
saw this one, yes.
So this one is directed by Rene Tajima Pena. And the description is that 40 years. I wasn't aware of this, by the way. This sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I wish I'd gone to watch this.
Yeah, I wish I'd gone to see it. I wasn't even aware of this case, but anyway, 40 years after the landmark case of Madrigal versus Quilligan, which investigated the sterilization of Mexican American women at the Los Angeles County and USC Medical Center, the 10 courageous women who challenged the system in 1978 break their silence. So apparently, the way I read this, as part of some kind of clinical experiment, these Mexican-American women were sterilized against their wishes, and they speak up, which sounds like a fascinating thing to approach as a documentary subject. So
yeah, so this movie, it was an incredibly powerful documentary. I wrote... This is a lot for me. I wrote two pages
should be an Instagram picture.
Full of notes about this one. Where do I start? So, yeah, it wasn't necessarily a clinical experiment. Yes, the issue was very politically motivated. In the 60s, in the 60s and 70s, there was this sense that, you know, immigration, it's a very hot button topic, politically. But there was a sense that... there were a couple of books that came out saying that, you know, America's population was growing too quickly. We weren't going to be able to sustain ourselves. There was going to be mass starvation. And so we needed to do something about population control. There was also a sense that, you know, foreigners were coming into the United States, particularly from Mexico, and they were coming in and they were having large families and they were having too many children. And so... the conspiracy theory part of this gets a little murky. They stop short of outright accusations, but they do suggest that within the medical community there were certain factions that felt that these women were having so many children, they were kind of putting their own lives at risk, but they were also some societal consequences around having too many children. It was centered around the LA County Hospital, and you know, the insurance situation being what it was back then, if you don't have medical care, if you don't have your own insurance, you can't go to a private hospital to deliver your child. You end up going to the emergency room, and LA County Hospital literally became overwhelmed. There were situations where people were having babies in corridors. You know, the lines were absolutely crazy. Like, you know, they even set up almost conveyor belt type situations where they would examine women, where, you know, a woman would be wheeled into an examination room and two doctors or three doctors would start, you know, one on the left breast, one on the right breast, one doing a vaginal exam, and then would move them through because they were so horrendously overwhelmed by the number of births and the system wasn't, you know, ready to cope with that. So the movie centers around what seems to have happened there is that some of these women, when they were in labor, were offered to have their tubes tied. But to any of us that work in any kind of clinical environment, the horrendous aspect of this was oftentimes they were presented with consent forms that were in English. Oftentimes they were suggested very heavily that they were offered these consent forms at a point at which you're in labor, the doctor says, please sign this so that you can get treatment. So they were actually signing while they were having these cesarean sections to also get their tubes tied. And a lot of them didn't actually know that they were being sterilized, according to the movie.
They didn't
understand what was going on. One woman said when she said sterilize, she thought that meant clean. Of course, I want, you know, clean antiseptic techniques. You know, she didn't understand that sterilization meant that she'd be no longer have more children. And the personal cost to these women was very high because, you know, within their communities, you know, a lot of them were immigrants from farming communities where they put a lot of emphasis on having lots of children. That was, you know, part of the way that they were raised. It's part of the way they wanted to be. And, you know, some of them were, you know, age 21, 22. They'd already had one or two children at the time that they were sterilized. But to not have any more when they wanted families of, you know, five, six children or more was devastating to them. And just the fact that the whole... there's so many issues in this movie that are kind of alluded to that I would not do it any justice by talking to it here, but it's definitely one to watch. It's an incredibly well-made documentary. It's reasonably well-balanced. I think it doesn't get too heavy-handed in terms of, like I say, there's insinuations that there was some sort of bigger conspiracy going on, but that has never been proven. And, you know, they wanted to not necessarily point fingers, but there are clearly some smoking guns here, and the court case was initially lost, but subsequently they were able to get some kind of recognition for what they went through.
Joe, I was going to say, I mean, clearly it's a really impassioned topic, but I guess in terms of a documentary, and I know you always say this about documentaries, is it a good documentary?
It's an incredibly good documentary. It's very well crafted. It makes a lot of points. It gives you points and counterpoints. I think it's an impassioned topic. I mean, clearly this movie has been made because they felt that they needed to get the voice of these women out there and to educate the world about a situation that occurred that was not right. That really we ought to be outraged about. And I think it's amazing to me that this even existed, that this even happened in the relatively recent past. That, you know, if you want to get, you know, very philosophical about it, it was one of the first things that, you know, Nazi Germany did was to mm-hmm. try and stop the population growth of what they thought was an ethnic group that they felt should not be propagating within their community. And, you know, we did that same thing here in the United States in the later part of the 20th century. So, again, it's falls short of saying that this was some sort of systematic government plan, but there were clearly elements within the medical community that felt that these women were having too many babies, whether or not they were coming from the fact that, you know, having four, five, six babies is not good for a particular woman's health. Maybe they felt that, you know, these people weren't able to support those children and they were making these decisions on that. But there's this insinuation that there was a group of, you know, primarily, you know, white American professionals within the medical community that thought that they were doing society a favor here by reducing the number of children that these women could have. And that inherently is what is at the center of this movie's outrage. And
I guess any of these documentaries that talk about, you know, a person's right to choose one thing or another, they're always going to be good. Right? When your choice gets taken away.
Yeah, but the topic is obviously one that's, you know, very fraught with pitfalls and landmines, rather, in terms of political debate. And it's important to get this message out there that this happened. And as a society, what do we learn? What should we learn about, you know, consent? I mean, you know, any kind of medical procedure, you know, be it as, you know, benign to having an ingrown toenail repaired, should only ever be done under consent. So terrific, terrific stuff. Very powerful. I was surprised that, you know, I think this was clearly a favorite for the audience award. I'm not sure it did pick up the audience award for documentary, but it was a very powerful movie. And I think one that's going to get some release because there's definitely a growing community behind this movie to get the word out there. No más bebés.
So I think, Joe, when you were watching that, I was watching the documentary In a Perfect World.
So, In a Perfect World is by director Daphne McWilliams, and the vulnerable and fearless, it's a vulnerable and fearless inquiry into the psyche of a generation of men who have been raised by single mothers, which begins when the filmmaker turns the camera on her own son and the father who left them behind. I think you were the only one who saw that, Rashmi.
I was, yeah. And there was actually a really interesting little short.
Oh, called Full Windsor.
Called Full Windsor, which is obviously a knot in a tie. Really interesting. So, again, it's always hard to say to people how you get hold of these shorts. Yeah. But a very, very interesting little documentary about a little boy who wants to wear his tie a certain way. And his mother doesn't want him to wear it that way because that's the way, obviously, that the abandoned father used to wear it. So really interesting little documentary, which I really liked. Okay, so In a Perfect World. You know, I have to give credit for this first time director. She was actually a producer, I think, of movies in the past, and this is her first directorial debut in documentary. I think it's an adequate documentary. It's certainly not as impassioned, Joe, as No Más Bebés. It basically tries to portray what it's like for men, young men who are growing up without fathers, whose fathers abandon them. I think its failing was that I didn't get an arc and I didn't quite get a narrative out of it. I think the narrative was supposed to be her own son, so she's basically going out and interviewing, you know, guys who have been raised by single mothers or without fathers, and then how they've now gone on to be fathers and the type of fathers they are. So it's interesting from that perspective, and she's trying to learn what advice she can give to her son who's a teenager to make him a better man in the long run, I guess, because, you know, no one wants the mistakes of the past repeated. And I think that's where she's trying to go. I mean, these men who she's interviewed and the lives they've made for themselves are very, very admirable. They've all gone on to do extremely good things. And, you know, what we saw was a very one-sided picture of the great fathers that they've become, despite the fact that they didn't have role models themselves. I think the failing is that it's not a very well-rounded documentary. And so it doesn't necessarily say, I'm sure that for all those men who are brought up by single women and don't have access to have an education or better their lives will probably make the same mistakes. So not bad, but not great. But an admirable, I think, entry into the documentary realm.
So many movies, so little time.
So then, Yazdi, you saw Atomic Heart, which was one of the ones I really wanted to watch. But as we always say, too many movies in too little time. And sometimes you just have three lines to choose from. So
I'll introduce that one just real quick. So it's directed by Ali Amazadeh. Sorry, Ali, for butchering your name there. But basic premise here, sometime around the witching hour, Arine and Nobahar, couple of characters, stumble out of a party giddy and spaced out, donning brightly dyed hair covered just enough by their headscarves. The young women drive around Tehran picking up their hipster buddy Cammy along the way, and in a moment of carefree distraction they get into a car that pivots right into the night into a bizarre series of events and possibility of a parallel world. So fascinating premise.
Yeah, I really wanted to watch this one.
Yazdi, what did you think of this one?
This movie is going to be very polarizing. Either you're going to love it or you're going to hate it.
Who do you think will love it and hate it out?
I think you'll both like it.
Oh, okay.
I think you'll both like
it. Who do you think will hate it then?
So I watched it with Afreed, and she didn't care for the movie at all. Okay. So our friend was there. And there were parts of it which tried my patience. But I think you... this is the problem, right? When you're trying to make a movie, you can kind of abide by genre conventions and try to exceed those conventions, or you can say, to hell with all the conventions, I'm just going to do something which refuses to bow to any convention. And when you are on that track, you can sometimes get indulgent, you can get a little bit out of focus. So I think if you want to criticize, I think this is a very well-made movie, by the way, and it's I think the only reason why it's playing at the film festival and it's going to do well, I think, eventually, if it does get released, is because there's nothing else quite like it. I haven't quite seen anything like it. You know, it's all very Kafkaesque. You know, it just seems surreal. People start behaving strangely, and it's part Mean Street, part Dusk Till Dawn.
Right. You know,
yeah. So it...
that sounds like a real head trip.
It is a head trip. And, you know, it starts off being about these two characters, and it's only in... I don't want to give too much away, but it's only in the final act of the movie that you realize that reality, as it has been playing around them, might not have been reality at all. And that different characters they have encountered might be something quite different than who they thought they were. Ooh. And there is this a last minute entry of this one character who is brilliant. It's played by this Iranian actor who looks like a younger, more handsome version of George Clooney. Go figure. But he, he just completely energizes the movie because he is this very dangerous character, and you don't really know, is he Satan? Is he evil?
Ooh.
You know, is he just somebody who's messing with their heads? And it kind of really plays by that. And then it becomes very obvious within this confines of the parallel universe what's playing out. But it's a very unpredictable movie from time to time. And yet somebody who can see it will just say nothing really happens in this movie. So it's kind of one of those movies which just ignores, there's no plot structure. Things just,
right.
You know, like...
unravel.
Things just unravel.
Yeah. So is it interesting? Because again, you know, I love these movies where we kind of get to travel to places where we wouldn't normally go. Mm-hmm. How much of Tehran do we get to see and what's that like?
It's pretty much shot exclusively in the outdoors in Tehran.
Okay.
And at night?
And at night. The whole movie plays out pretty much in real time. I think it's the 2 hours that the movie plays is 2 hours actually. The movie starts with these two girls leaving a party. And, you know, they've had a great party, they've enjoyed themselves, and they're just for the heck of it, they start driving, you know, on a road where they're going in the opposite direction.
Ooh.
You know, and apparently they do that all the time, and then they run into these different characters, and there's a car accident which happens off screen, and they encounter all these other, you know, characters. I think the only part which I found, and a lot of the audience was restless, is the movie begins with a shot of this character, which is standing by an elevator. They're leaving the party and she's waiting for her friend to come back so they can leave the party. And it's a good 1.5 minute shot of the elevator door closing and she won't let it close. And it closes and she won't let it close. So she's just playing. You know how if you keep putting your hand
the
elevator, and that goes on for like an hour and a half. And it's like, please, somebody stop, stop. I can't take this anymore. And then this thing happens.
An hour and a half.
No, a minute and a half. Okay. Sorry, a minute and a half. And then this kind of repeats itself later on. And it's only after I've thought for a long time, the movie's actually making the case that maybe they're going into a different portal. By moving the elevator doors back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, they kind of shifted into a portal. And they almost have to do it again to come back to reality. Or maybe I'm reading too much into it. But it's the kind of movie which says... you know, it's fun to watch the elevator door just go back and forth for a minute and a half. But
okay,
there's nothing quite like it. It's not for everyone. I know that the person who organizes the San Diego Asian Film Festival, he was there and he just absolutely loved the movie. And he's going to show it at the San Diego Asian Film Festival.
Okay, wow. So that's good for us.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think final movie...
Yep, Infinitely Polar Bear.
The LA Film Festival.
For us this year. Unfortunately, we weren't able to see more because the way the festival runs.
I think I could have watched more.
Well, yeah, we were pretty movied out at the end of the 3 days, but we did finish on, I think was a good note, which was Infinitely Polar Bear. So... Yasti, tell us about Infinitely Polar Bear.
So Infinitely Polar Bear is by director Maya Forbes, and I believe this might be her directorial debut.
Correct.
And it stars Zoe Saldana as well as our favorite Mark Ruffalo. And it's the story of a manic, depressive mess of a father who tries to win back his wife by attempting to take full responsibility of their two young, spirited daughters. And this is a story of 2,000 movies that have been made, I guess. But I know this has been getting a lot of good buzz and it seems like my kind of film. But
yeah, of course I think it's definitely going to get a release because it has the likes of J.J. Abrams behind it as well. Okay, so I had really high hopes for this one. I think what it does really well is... really give us a look into what depression must be like for a person and for those who have to experience it in their family. And this is actually what would you call this, autobiographical of the director? So it's director-writer. And, you know, it's a really sweet movie and it's gritty. Again, it's one of those that I think is just shy of greatness. It's very good. It's very good. Mark Ruffalo's very good. In my mind, it's, you know, he's such a great actor. It's a tad overplayed.
Mm. Which is very unlike him. Usually yeah. He tends to...
But I'm interested to see what you think, Joe, because we didn't really get a chance to talk about this one, I think.
I'll disagree with you in that it's a tad overplayed. I think it's a tad overwritten,
okay.
More than anything. I think he... let's just start off by saying this is a lovely little movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it has that very small independent film feel to it. It's clearly material that is very precious to the writer-director because it is so very personal. In accordance with that, it does kind of step over the line into preciousness at times. Mm. You know, we have these very kind of insightful, wise children, which is always a, you know.
Precocious, yeah.
Well.
That's a good word.
It gets a little, like, it takes you away from the reality of the moment. I mean, you know, these children are often wise beyond their age. And you know what? Kids can sometimes be wise beyond their age, but the way that they talk and their dialogue and so on and so forth, you know, and the kind of things that they have to deal with and the way that they handle it. In many ways, it feels like this movie was trying to be this year's Silver Linings Playbook.
Yeah.
It has that same sensibility to it. It's just not as expertly crafted. But it's a very sympathetic portrayal of somebody who has mental illness. And I think one of the things that the writer-director was trying to get from this movie was, you know, why are we always talking about the crazy guy, you know, in a movie? Why can't they be, you know, a sympathetic character? And, you know, why do they always have to be filled with darkness? This is, you know, a real condition that people have. You know, depression, it manifests itself in... It's bipolar, manic. So he has crazy highs and crazy lows, and you know, we deal with that as the audience with some of the, you know, the ways that manifests itself within the family. But you know, not a perfect movie by any sense, but it's definitely a very enjoyable film. I think you know, the characters are all very well drawn. I feel like you know, Ruffalo in particular did a very good job here of you know, of depicting, you know, the difficulties of having those kind of ups and downs, and you know, what it's like to be on medication, you know, how that kind of dulls your emotions and the effect that can have on your family and the people around you as well. So but it's very, very sweet, and you know, I think, you know, ultimately that sweetness, you know, starts to give one just a little toothache, and it's a nitpick. I mean, go see this movie. You'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a Yazdi and Joe movie. I think it, for me, it was a little bit, I think overcooked is probably the right word, Joe. I think overwritten is probably right. I think it goes to a bit of crazy town without us going along with the journey. You know, it goes from like zany, funny to, angry, as opposed to, which is probably what bipolar is like.
That's the whole point.
That's the whole point. But it lacked authenticity for me, I think. That's the one piece I think it lacked. And had it been a little bit more authentic, and I think had a few more lows, real lows, that take you on that journey of what it's like to be with that person when they're on their low, may have elevated this movie a little bit more. Great performances, but again, I wish...
I think what you're pointing out here is...
had dialed it back a little bit.
Well, I think what you're observing here, Rashmi, is that, you know, this was really the writer-director's family that he was talking about. And he wanted to give them the level of respect that, you know, his love for them had. So he didn't want to take these characters to dark places. And I think he wanted to depict what some of the difficulties are of living with mental illness, but... not so much that, you know, we see the, you know, the demons come sprawling out of the you know, the situation. So
yeah, that very admirable mother, though. Zoe Saldana does, I think, a really good job in this movie of portraying the mother, the wife character. And actually, we were in the audience with the writer director's family, as well as Mark Ruffalo's family and Mark Ruffalo as well. So, this seemed like a big family affair.
Was Zoe Saldana there?
Yeah, Zoe Saldana was there. Maya Forbes was there. Her sister, the two characters in the movie, both were there. Her sister actually wrote a movie, wrote a song for the movie that was supposed to play with the credits that they never played. So she was really pissed. Shame. That was a shame. We were actually behind her walking out of the theater, and she was complaining to her family friend.
Well,
I can't believe they cut the song.
No, I mean, it must be frustrating to kind of contribute your art to a project and then no one gets to hear it. So that was hard, especially when it's your big moment, right?
But I do like how it tackles race, wealth, depression, and class. Kind of covers all of those things.
She was so good. Remember last year in Into the Furnace?
Yeah, she also
played. Yes, that's right.
Christian Bale's wife, right. Yeah. Kids, and
she felt like a more well-rounded character in this, which I really liked.
Yeah,
she was very strong, and she was really the intelligent, supportive one with a lot to carry in
the
this
anchor,
movie.
The anchor of the family.
Yeah,
yeah.
Overall, though, that was a terrific way to end the film festival.
Yeah.
I mean, again, we've been covering this film festival for several years now, and I think this was up there among the best years that we've covered. I mean,
definitely.
For me,
applause all around for the people who picked these movies. They were all incredible.
So what would all of your favorite pick be? If you had to choose one movie of the ones that you've seen... I'll start because that'll give you a chance to look through your notes. But for me, head and shoulders above everything else that we saw is Diary of a Teenage Girl. Runner-up would be Sweet and Vicious, but Diary of a Teenage Girl is just a spectacular piece of work that I personally think will carry its momentum through to the end of the year. I mean, it's a little early for award season, but... that if that movie gets no recognition, in at least in the screenwriting category, then there is no justice in the world.
I have to agree with you, Joe. I would actually do it the other way around, though. Sweet and Vicious for me was just mind-blowing. I mean, it just blew me away how good that movie was. And then, Diary of a Teenage Girl has just stopped me short. I can't stop thinking about it.
Yazdi?
For me, it would be a tie between Sweet and Vicious as well.
My last thing was,
and it's already tomorrow in Hong Kong. I really love that movie.
Hopefully we'll get to make an interview with the director.
With the director. The director of Sweet and Vicious, Juan Paulo Lacerna. We would love to speak with him. I have 100 questions for him. If you're listening to this podcast, please.
Yeah,
and not that he is.
I did like Puerto Ricans in Paris, though. That was cute.
Yeah.
So, just thank you again to Film Independent for putting on a terrific LA Film Festival 2015.
Brilliant.
One of my favorite times of the year right now. I think it's a real highlight. And honestly, I'll sound like a broken record here, but film festivals, if you're into film enough to listen to this podcast and our banter for hours on end, then you deserve to get yourself to a film festival. LA Film Festival is probably an easy one to break yourself, to cut your teeth on. So go there, enjoy.
Amen.
Okay. I guess that wraps up our coverage for 2015 LA Film Fest. But if you have any questions, mail at moviewallers.com, twitter.com/moviewallers, facebook.com/moviewallers as well. Check our website for a couple of photo sets that we have from the film festival. And if you haven't caught them already, there were two other podcasts with material here. And we'll make sure to tag these movies should they get releases later in the year and refer you back to our full reviews here. So.
And I should also say that this, of all the years we've been attending the Film Independent LA Film Festival, this is the first year that they decided to have separate press screenings.
Oh, that was so wonderful. Thank you, LA Film Festival,
because I know it's a bear to run a whole screening for, 20 people in the audience, but it's so worth it because, there's only that many more movies you can watch.
Oh, exactly. So, it really did enhance the experience for us.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Too many movies.
That was indeed too many movies in too little time. So, a good night from me.
And me.
And me as well.